I've got a simple question for you. Does God approve of the quarantine? We'll be talking about that coming up next, right here on the Parker J. Cole Show. Welcome to another edition of the Parker J. Cole Show. I'm your host, Parker J. Thank you so much for being with us today. I hope you guys are staying safe and staying healthy and staying at home. Or do I really think that? One thing about this whole situation that we find ourselves in is that there is a lot of conflicting information. It's very true that we want to make sure that our loved ones stay healthy. It's very true that we want our loved ones who are sick to get well. It's also very true that so many of us are heartbroken that those who have been taken by the COVID-19 virus are not able to have the proper burials and memorials and funerals because we're all trying to keep each other safe. Should we be concerned about that? Another thing that has happened is that within the United States in particular, there's a massive divide when it comes to gathering together for various events. States have issued executive orders restricting gathering together. Some people call it social distancing. Some people call it government infringement on our rights. There's a lot going on with this, and we are seeing the world in a way we never thought we would see it before. A lot of things about our economy is coming to play. A lot of things about our health system is coming to light. A lot of things, because of this pandemic, is bringing up all kinds of worms. We've opened up a massive can of worms. And with that, believers in particular have to ask themselves the question, does God approve of the quarantine? Some people say it is not anyone's right to infringe on what I do with my life. That includes, I don't care if there's a pandemic going on. If I want to go to whatever place I want to go to, no one can tell me what to do that. On the other hand, you have believers saying, but wait a minute, it's the law of the land. We have to obey the law of the land. Plus, people are dying from the pandemic. Shouldn't you just obey the law of the land? There's so much confusion, so much reactionary type of vitriol out there that I thought, you know what, let's talk about this. Because even myself, I don't know what to think. And I would love to have some clarity. So I reached out to a gentleman. His name is Bill Fortenberry. He is a researcher, author, and theologian. And I believe he's going to give us a really balanced view of this. I'm not saying that he's 100% unbiased. I don't think anyone can be. But as much as possible, he's going to give us a balanced view about whether or not God approves of the quarantine. We're going to be looking at some interesting examples from the Bible. We're also going to be looking at freedoms, and we're going to be looking at governments, and we're going to be compare and contrasting. So there's a lot going on with this topic. We'll try to really minimize it and break it down to concrete and discrete chunks for you to consume. If you want to weigh in on our conversation, you know you can by simply calling in at 646-668-8485, then press 1 to be live on air, or hit me on Twitter at Parker J. Cole, hashtag PJC Show, with your questions or comments. We're going to go ahead and take a quick short break. We'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
Sofa Talk podcast will consider Spurgeon's morning and evening devotionals, which deal with all of the things that we are fearful and anxious of, like job, family, and our country. Plus, we will take your prayer requests. Join us on upcoming episodes Monday through Friday for Sofa Talk at anchor.fm/russell-sherard. That's anchor.fm/russell-sherard.
Christian authors and writers, welcome to Readio. Readio app developed exclusively for showcasing Christian fiction and nonfiction ebooks and audiobooks. Losing sales due to incorrect algorithm influence categorization? Books lost amongst non-Christian content? Readio allows you to reach your target audience, who's eager to devour your Christian, faith-based books in a variety of subgenres. You write in a niche market. Readio solely caters to it. Become a content contributor and receive early notification of when you can start uploading your content. Go to twotigersllc.com and sign up today. Readio, the app for great Christian books. Follow us on social media at twotigersllc.
Hi, and welcome back to the show. You're listening to The Parker J. Cole Show on WPJC 104.5. Again, very glad you are here with me today. We're going to be talking about, does God approve of the quarantine? And as I mentioned in my introduction to this particular episode, I want to make sure that we have, as much as possible, a balanced view of what is right to do in a situation that is out of control like this pandemic. Like I said earlier, a lot of things about our economy, about our government, about healthcare, and so many other things are coming to the light because of the pandemic. And so we are hoping that we are learning a lot of things so that if this ever happens again, we don't have to be swayed back and forth on opinion. We have something to work with. Plus, through it all, the Lord has been with us no matter how destitute the situation may look or how depressing it may look. God is still here with us. I shared with you last week that what's happening, well, not with you, but on a blog I did recently called God is Our Creator, during this pandemic, one thing that has been happening is that people have been seeking Him more. And I think when things like this happen, we should be seeking, what does the Lord want me to do? How does the Lord want me to react? How does the Lord want me to respond to certain things? So that's why I have my good friend Bill Fortenberry here with me. As I said before, he is a researcher, author, and theologian. And I believe he's going to give us a very balanced view about, does God approve of the quarantine? But he's going to quantify that with some things that we should consider. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my guest co-host and contributor today, Bill Fortenberry. Bill, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
I want to thank you so much for being with me on the show. Always great to have you. You know, I can't believe, I think it's been just a little under 10 years that I've known you, Bill, because my birthday just passed. And I know how old I was when I met you. So it's a little bit under 10 years that I've known you. And I sit there kind of like, when did that happen? You know what I mean, Bill? When did I start to get older? My mother would say every day, every minute. And I said, Mom, you are no help right now. So anyway, I'm just so glad to have you back with me, helping us with the topic. I introduced you very quickly as an author, theologian, and researcher, but go ahead and just add any more to that so people can know who you are.
Well, you know, that's a very dangerous question. You know, when people ask me to talk about myself, I don't know if I'm supposed to brag about myself and people think I'm full of pride, or if I'm supposed to say negative things about myself and then people think I'm being prideful about being humble. And, you know, it's just
You can't win. You can't win.
But you mentioned my research, and I do a lot of research. It's something that I love to do, especially if it's real and meaningful research. And I've been blessed to be able to conduct some research on some pretty significant topics. So just kind of give a little bit of my qualifications, I guess. I have done research on things like on ectopic pregnancy, discovered more than 500 children have been born alive from ectopic pregnancies, and found evidence through my research that both the mother and the child can survive that type of pregnancy. So it's not a death sentence if they go through it, and it's not a mandate for abortion. And that was a thrilling bit of research to get done. I've also done legal research. In fact, my legal research on abortion in Alabama provided the background or the backbone for the wrongful death suit that some of your listeners may have heard about. Ryan Majors in Alabama is suing an abortion clinic because they aborted and killed his child with permission of the mother. You know, she went and had an abortion. And the court is allowing him to sue the clinic for the death of that child, sue them for a wrongful death. And that's based on my legal research. I've also done research on Benjamin Franklin. I've got a book out on Franklin on Faith. It takes Benjamin Franklin's own words, tell about his account from his conversion from deism to Christianity. And I'm working right now on a book that hopefully will be released sometime this year. I'm still looking for an agent and a publisher, but the book's finished, on birthright citizenship. And I can say more about that at the end of the show if we have time. So just love doing a lot of meaningful research and had the chance to do that in the past. Looking forward to more areas where God will open us the opportunity to do significant research.
I think that just lets us know a lot about your character, because it's nice to have an opinion, but what do you have to back up your opinion? And I know, for example, I always say my opinion is worth about 5 cents because I have to account for inflation. It used to be 2 cents, now it's 5 cents because of inflation. But at the same time, you want to make sure that what your opinions are based on can be supported in some way. Now, we're not talking about, you know, do you think chocolate ice cream is better than chocolate cake? We're not talking about preferences. You know, we're talking about real things. Like you talked about abortion, which you are a huge advocate for. And you also have the Personhood Initiative, which is how we actually connected, was through the Personhood Initiative of Alabama. And there's other things that you do a lot of research on. And I think that type of thing is important. The last time you were on our show, we talked about Old Testament laws and the Constitution, how they're very much in sync with each other. And that was a fun show. A lot of people were surprised at some of the information that you presented on the show. And I looked, when I got up, you know, private feedback from people. So some people are surprised about that. And so I want to talk about this thing about, does God approve of the quarantine? And so I want to start to, as much as we possibly can, really break this down for people. I think it's important that we try to come at it from different angles. And so with that, my first question is coming up. I have sent you a list of questions. I just want to pull up, make sure I ask the right question. So my first question basically starts with this. What do we currently know about how effective social distancing is in combating the coronavirus?
Well, that's a good question, and it's got two different answers. First of all, the social distancing was never really intended to combat the virus. The goal of the social distancing measures was to slow the spread of the virus, and that's a different type of goal. And there's a very important difference between those two. To actually combat the virus, we would be implementing measures to stop the virus from spreading to non-infected people. The various social distancing orders, however, were never intended to do that. Their purpose was to keep hospitals from being overwhelmed by getting too many cases all at once. So the idea is to set up a situation in which the virus would spread through the community more slowly than it would under normal circumstances. So it's not to stop it from spreading, but to just make it spread a little more slowly. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that those orders haven't really been effective in accomplishing that goal. You could say that they've been effective where they've been followed properly and their intent has been followed. But personally, I don't know any community where the various social distancing orders and the stay-at-home orders have been followed in the spirit of the law. Some of them have been followed in the letter of the law, but very seldom in the spirit of the law. The goal of all these orders was to keep people from being around each other, but all they really accomplished was to funnel everyone in the community through the doors of a small select group of businesses that were deemed to be essential. So just to give you an example, my wife and I, we usually drink a cup of hot tea together every night, watch a movie or something after our son goes to bed, you know, just to keep that spark of romance going. And a few days ago, we ran out of tea bags, and we wanted to go buy some more, but we couldn't go to the small store where we usually buy our tea because they had been deemed a non-essential business, so they were closed. So instead of going to this small store where we would have had very little exposure to other people around us, we were forced to go to a large grocery store that was filled with people. And
yeah.
Those people may or may not have been carriers of the virus. And so the order closing down the smaller businesses and saying that those are non-essential actually increased our risk of contracting the virus. And so I don't think these orders have been effective at all because they're just funneling the whole community through a few select businesses rather than letting people stay separate and go to the businesses that are less crowded in order to avoid people.
You know, one of our listeners seems to support what you just said. Jeremy from Louisiana. Thank you, Jeremy, for joining in the conversation. He's responding to the show description where I said it's common knowledge that the states have implemented quarantine procedures in order to mitigate the spread of the pandemic. And Jeremy says, keep in mind that it was always going to spread. There's literally nothing you can do to stop it. The mitigation's purpose was only to prevent the hospitals getting overrun with bodies. That didn't happen. The statistical models were all wrong, and yes, they all factored in heavy mitigation procedures. Many people assume that mitigation helped stop the spread of the virus. That is not correct. It just flattened the curve so that hospitals could, and puts in parentheses, potentially handle the load. Jeremy, thank you so much for that insight into our topic. What would you say to what he's talking about, Bill?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. That stopping the virus was never the goal. It's just to slow it down. But even at that, they didn't do it correctly. And so there was never any hope that these orders would be effective at even slowing down the spread of the virus just because of the way that they were implemented.
Now, my next question deals with the conflict over the quarantine guidelines, and there's a lot of that. So there are those who are for the strict guidelines and others who are against it. And so before I want you to answer that question in full, what I would like you to do is tell us what things do we need to consider when evaluating this topic?
That's a good question. Anytime that we're evaluating a law, and an order that comes from the government, and we're trying to decide should we obey it or should we not, there's four things that we need to keep in mind. First of all is biblical guidance. In this case, we would want to look at how God instructed Israel to handle infectious diseases, and we'd want to ask questions like, is there anything in the Bible about using masks or quarantines or sanitization and, you know, things like that, and just see if there's anything in the Bible that tells us what we're supposed to do. Next, we would want to look at the constitutional requirements. We would want to look at whether the Constitution rather says that the government has the right to prevent businesses from operating. If it does say that they can do that, what is the government's responsibility to those businesses when they give that order? And so then we want to look at the state and local authority, see what kind of laws are in place for on the state level and on the local level, or quarantines and shelter-in-place orders, and again, the right to prevent businesses from operating and their responsibility. And then, of course, we want to look at our individual responsibility, whether we have a responsibility to resist those orders or if we have a responsibility to comply with those orders. And for that, we have to look at what the law says and also what the Bible says and consider things like the potential to sue the government as a result of these orders. So we want to keep those four categories in mind: biblical guidance, constitutional requirements, state and local authority, and then individual responsibility.
I like how those four categories that you gave kind of comes from a way big picture to a small picture. So you see how what the Bible shows us what has happened in the past, because we do know there's nothing new under the sun. We do know that things pretty much have happened before. And that, for some reason, that gives me a lot of comfort, Bill. That always comforts me. Like, you know, it's not the first time this has happened. And guess what? It won't be the last. And I remember Ravi Zacharias saying about Bertrand Russell, he was like, history is just old things happening to new people. So yeah. I have to agree with that for sure. So you got a biblical view, then you got a governmental view, which is the federal government, then you have the state and local authorities, then me, what do I do? And lets us know that we all matter. So you have this, I don't want to say a pyramid, but just categories that are like circles within circles within circles. I like that illustration better. And so I'm glad that you broke that down, because as we discuss this topic, you're going to be coming from one of these categories, I think. So what I want to do before we start to break down into that, let me take a quick short break with you, Bill. And then for those of you listening in, you can call in at 646-668-8485, then press 1 to be live on air, or hit me on Twitter at Parker J. Cole, hashtag PJC Show, with your questions or comments. We're going to go ahead and take a quick short break. We'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, friends. I'm Dr. Mike Spaulding, inviting you to listen to great Bible teaching on the Transforming Word radio show and podcast. All shows are available on iTunes and Stitcher. Search for the Transforming Word and subscribe for notification of new shows. You may also listen to every episode from my website, www.thetransformingword.com. In addition to The Transforming Word, I want to make you aware of my interview, news, and opinion show, Soaring Eagle Radio. If you're interested in engaging conversations related to a variety of topics not covered by typical news media, then check out Soaring Eagle Radio. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher, and you may listen to every episode on my website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. For more information on my ministries, please email me, Pastor Mike at cclohio.com. Again, that's Pastor Mike at cclohio.com. Thank you for listening to these shows, and please leave me a note when you do. God bless you today.
God gives humans the gift of making amazing stories to glorify Him. At SpeculativeFaith.com, our ministry is to help fans explore fantasy, science fiction, supernatural stories, and beyond from an intentional and biblical Christian perspective. We share daily articles and have extensive archives tackling hot topics like end times beliefs, the art of writing, creative excellence in the Christian subcultures, discernment, sex, magic, Harry Potter, and space aliens and the Bible. If you are a parent or anyone else with a discriminating palate, our reviewers explore fantastical novels, movies, television, and games in light of God's beauty, goodness, and truth. Want to find Christian stories? The SpecFaith Library lists every fantastical novel we can find from a Christian author. It's all part of our mission to discern, engage, and enjoy fantastical human creativity in honor of our Creator, Jesus Christ. SpeculativeFaith.com, exploring fantastical stories for God's glory.
Hi, and welcome back to the show. You're listening to The Parker J. Cole Show on WPJC 104.5. We are talking today about the proof of the quarantine. We're trying to break this down into discrete, concrete chunks so you can evaluate it. With me to help us unpack this topic is my good friend Bill Fortenberry. He is a researcher, theologian, and also an author. Before the break, what he said when we answer these types of questions is we have to break it down to roughly four categories. And those four categories illustrate to us how we can look at it from the big picture to the small picture. So from what God has implemented in the past to what we can do now. And the first thing he mentioned was biblical guidance and how God instructed Israel to handle infectious diseases. We're going to get to that in a minute. And then we go into constitutional requirements. And then the next thing we'll get into is local and state authority. And then finally, we'll talk about individual responsibility. And so Bill is going to unpack that for us as we continue in our conversation. And if you want to weigh in, as always, you certainly can by calling in at 646-668-8485. And once again, Bill, thank you so much for being with me on the show. Always glad, as I say, to have you. So I want to go to my next question. Obeying the laws of the land is important. However, I believe we need to quantify that. For example, infanticide is now part of the law, and I refuse to obey that. And for those of you who don't know, you can now kill a child outside the mother's womb. I'm not making that up. I'm not being, dramatic. It's the law. You can do that now. So I need you, Bill, to break this down for us and help us to quantify exactly what it means about obeying the law of the land.
All right. Well, to answer that question, First, you need to lay down some foundational principles. There's a huge debate in theological circles about exactly when and how Christians should refuse to obey laws that contradict the Bible. And, you know, of course, we don't have time to go into all the details on that, but my position on that question is that we should obey the government as long as they do not order us to violate a greater law. Now, the greatest law, of course, is the law of God. So we as Christians have a responsibility to resist any government that orders us to violate the law of God. But this principle also includes man-made laws like the U.S. Constitution, our treaties with foreign nations, our various state constitutions. So I would say we have a duty, both as Christians and as citizens, to refuse to obey any order that violates any of these greater laws. Now, having said that, let me also say that I don't think that the majority of the orders which have been issued during this crisis have violated any greater laws. And I know, of course, you're going to have a lot of listeners who would disagree with that statement. I realize there have been some instances in which the orders have been a clear violation of either the Bible or the Constitution or both. But most of the orders that I've looked at have been legally and morally valid. Doesn't mean that they're wise, doesn't mean that they're effective, but they've actually been on solid legal grounds, and they haven't violated any commands of Scripture. And I think I can show that to be the case if we work through those four guidelines that we mentioned earlier. First, the biblical guidance and the constitutional requirements to begin with, and then follow that with the consideration of local and state authority and individual responsibility. So for the biblical guidance, the Bible actually has a lot to say about pandemics. This is nothing new, as you mentioned. It's nothing new under the sun. People have been dealing with pandemics for thousands and thousands of years. So in the Bible, there's two main passages where God gave Israel instructions on how to deal with two different infectious diseases. Those are found in Leviticus 14, which deals with the disease of leprosy, and Numbers 31, which deals with some unnamed disease, and we haven't been able to figure out exactly what it is. It's just kind of described there in the Bible. But in those two passages, God gave Israel instructions on how to deal with two infectious diseases, and those instructions were basically the same in both cases. And in these passages, God laid out a four-step process for combating infectious biological agents. And those steps were quarantine for the first, quarantine of the infected and potentially infected until they are no longer contagious. Second, requiring the infected to wear a mask anytime they have to venture into public. That's not anything new. That was actually required by God all the way back in the book of Numbers or book of Leviticus, where anyone who had leprosy had to wear a mask over their mouth and nose in order to prevent the disease from spreading. It also demanded improved personal hygiene for the infected and the potentially infected. And in both cases, God demanded sanitization of all the potentially contaminated surfaces. So those orders, ordering the stores to wipe down their counters in between customers and things like that, that's nothing new. God had that all the way back in Numbers 31. So these are excellent guidelines that our communities have successfully applied countless times throughout the past. There's been all kinds of times where the government has said, okay, we need to quarantine this particular group of people because they've been infected with the disease, and they need to go through decontamination, and we need to sanitize all the surfaces they've been in contact with, and that's been done over and over and over again. And so the primary difference between these guidelines and the orders being issued now is the fact that in the Bible, when God gave those guidelines, they were only applied to those who were infected or potentially infected with the disease. And, you know, these diseases back then, they weren't any less deadly than the coronavirus. One of them, the one in Numbers 31, killed 23,000 people in a single day. Now, that's 4% of the total population of the nation at that time. That's
wow.
A massive rate of death from that particular disease. And when God had people quarantined as a result of that, the quarantine was for as many as 12,000 people that were isolated from the rest of the nation. So it wasn't minor things, it was major diseases, full-blown plagues, and yet even then, God only allowed the Israelites to interrupt the lives and the livelihoods of those who are actually or potentially infected. The rest of the population was permitted to live their lives, you know, just like normal, like nothing was going on. And that's not the way that the government is handling things now. That's the way they've handled similar situations in the past. And there's been a time or two where they've handled it wrong and handled it like today. But for the most part, in America, we've generally followed the biblical guidelines. And so that's the way the Bible teaches us to respond to infectious biological agents and diseases and things. But we need to also recognize that, having said that, that the government's doing it different from what the Bible says, and we would be better off if they followed the Bible. Having said that, we should also realize that the methodology that was given in the Bible was only given as a command for the nation of Israel. God didn't say this is what every nation should do. He just said this is what I want you to do. And so there's nothing in the Bible to indicate that God requires all other nations to follow those same instructions. And I think we'd be wise to do so. And you know, if you can learn anything at all from history, you can learn the most by studying God's history. But it doesn't mean that we're required to follow everything that God said in the Bible for the nation of Israel. So I don't think that Christians can point to these instructions, like I've seen many of them do. I don't think it's right to point to those instructions and say the government's not doing it the way that God did it back in the Bible. Therefore, we should resist the social distancing orders and resist the stay-at-home orders, and we have biblical grounds for doing that. I don't think that's a good argument. Now, there is another aspect of the biblical guidance that a lot of people point to, and we need to consider it as well, and that's the command in Hebrews 10 that Christians are not to forsake the assembling of themselves together. We believe that the stay-at-home orders are a violation of this command in Hebrews.
Right.
I have a different opinion on that. I don't think that it's a violation of that command. And I've got a couple of reasons for that. First of all, Hebrews 10:25 doesn't really specify how often Christians are to assemble together. It doesn't say that we have to make sure that we assemble together at least three times every week, or twice a week, or once a week, or twice a month, or once a month. You know, there's no statement of how often Christians are to assemble together. It simply says we're not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together, which means we're not to turn away from it. We're not to abandon that practice of assembling together. Several of our governments have told us to refrain from assembling together in a church building, and they've only told us to do that for a temporary period of time. They haven't ordered us to abandon the practice of assembling altogether. They've just asked that we do not do so within a specified range of dates, and that's a very contentious position for me to say that, but I think that's what the Bible says. And let me illustrate with a couple of quick examples.
Okay.
I live here in Alabama, and here we have frequent tornadoes. It's very common to have tornadoes, and many times they're devastating to whole communities. In fact, we had one just it was either last week or the week before. We had one that had a few deaths as a result of a tornado coming through. And I can't count how many times my church has canceled services because of the imminent threat of tornadoes.
Right.
It's just common sense to do that. It's not a violation of Hebrews 10:25 for a church to sensibly tell its members to stay home during a tornado watch. That's just common sense. And no one argues that's a violation of Hebrews 10:25. Also, nearly all of us have missed a church service or two because we were physically ill. My wife, for example, suffered a stroke 14 years ago, just after our son was born, and neither of us attended church services during the month that she was in the hospital. That doesn't mean we were forsaking or abandoning during that time. We realized intuitively that being temporarily hindered from attending church is not the same thing as turning away from church and turning away from the assembly. And you can even see this in the Bible. Jesus himself, speaking about the Sabbath, which is a similar type of command that was given to the Jews, similar to the command for us to assemble together. And he recognized that the Sabbath has exceptions. He said one of the exceptions that he listed was rescuing an ox from a pit. You know, on the Sabbath, the Jews were not to do any work. But Jesus said, if you rescue an ox from a pit on the Sabbath day, that's okay, because, you know, the purpose of the Sabbath is to make your life better. It's not to make your life worse. So your oxen that are your livelihood dying in that pit because you couldn't, you know, do the work of getting a rope and pulling them out. That would be making your life worse, which is not what the Sabbath was intended for. And so this idea that Hebrews 10:25 means the church can never cancel a service and can never go any period of time without the assembly, I don't think that's a bad idea. So in the area of biblical guidelines, my opinion is that our government off if they follow the guidelines established for Israel. But I don't think that we have any biblical justification in general for refusing to obey the stay-at-home orders. Now, there are exceptions to that, obviously. The church or churches in Mississippi that were fined for having a drive-in service, that was 100% unconstitutional. And, you know, I think the churches were right to defy that order and to assemble in that drive-in type of a church service. I think everything they did there was completely correct. But in general, most of these orders are not, in my opinion, a violation of the biblical commands. From that, we can go to the constitutional requirements. I'm throwing a lot of information at you. Did you want me to stop for anything before going into the constitutional requirements?
Well, I wanted to piggyback on something that you said, because I think it was very eye-opening about Hebrews 10:25. Because when I was getting ready for the show this morning, that was the first thing I noticed. It says, not forsaking the assembly of ourselves together. And many of us have not attended church if something has happened. Sometimes we don't attend church because we are going on vacation. You know what I mean? Like, we are going on vacation and we're going to, let's say, some tropical paradise. And we're going to enjoy ourselves. We haven't forsaken church assembly. We just didn't go to church that day, you know. And it doesn't have to be about sickness. Some people have not gone to church because they were tired. Some people have not gone to church because they had to work. But all of a sudden, the government, and a lot of people have issues with the government, and I understand that, says, well, don't go because of X, Y, and Z. And then we want to, you know, hold up our banners of righteousness. And I like how you very bluntly but respectfully said, you know, there are certain exceptions, and you gave that example, which I think is on point. Particularly, I like the fact you used about the tornadoes and how you said my church canceled, you know, we canceled service because there's a tornado a-coming, you know, and so, you know, there's a tornado a-coming. I mean, I don't want to. I want to be back later to praise the Lord. I don't want to praise the Lord whirling in a cyclone, you know. It'd be kind of hard to sing, you know. So, yeah, I totally agree with that. And then one of my listeners here, R.D. Palmer, he says, Bill makes a lot of sense. Today we can have church virtually. Think of the elderly that can't be in a physical church building. R.D., thank you for joining in the conversation, because I think he's right. There are some people who can't get out and about. Don't we have sick and shut-in lists? You know, some of the smaller churches I know, we have sick and shut-in lists. You know, you list the people, so-and-so can't get out. I remember one young lady, she said, I was bedridden for 2 years. She couldn't go anywhere. And so she had a personal devotions, but then that's when she started watching, like, TV pastors. This is before the virtual stuff. So she watched TV pastors and stuff like that, because she wasn't forsaking God, she was just couldn't go. You know, she couldn't go. So I liked that you put that qualifier in there, and I appreciate that. Let's go next to the next category we can consider, and that will talk about the Constitution. So let's go into that next.
Okay. All right. When we look at the Constitution, there are two sections of the Constitution that apply to these stay-at-home orders. The one that's received the most attention is the First Amendment, and particularly you have the Free Exercise Clause and the Freedom of Assembly Clause in the First Amendment. The Free Exercise Clause forbids Congress from prohibiting the free exercise of religion, and a lot of people complain that the stay-at-home orders are prohibiting Christians from the free exercise of their religion. But let me go on to the Freedom of Assembly Clause real quick. That one prevents Congress from passing laws that prohibit a specific class of assemblies. And there are many people who claim that the stay-at-home orders violate this clause as well, but neither the Free Exercise Clause or the Freedom of Assembly Clause is an unlimited prohibition. And I know that's contrary to what most people taught and what most people think, but when you study the history of these clauses in these laws, it's pretty obvious from a historical standpoint that they're not unlimited. And let me explain that a little bit. Starting with freedom of assembly, that's declared in the Constitution to only apply to assemblies that are peaceable and which are conducted for the purpose of petitioning the government for a redress of grievances. That's the type of assembly that is protected by that clause. It was intended to be a limit on the charges of treason and sedition, not to be a license to hold meetings whenever and wherever we want. Your right to peacefully assembly, for example, does not give you the right to have a tailgate party on the White House lawn at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, you can't do that and just say, oh, I have the right to peacefully assembly. You know, there's limits to the particular right. And I don't think that the majority of the stay-at-home orders have encroached upon that right. There may be exceptions, and I admit that there could be exceptions to that, but I don't think for the majority that they have encroached on that right. The free exercise clause is something that gets a lot more attention, though, and that's that clause is also limited in its scope, even though it's the petition itself. So, for example, as that the freedom of religion does not include human sacrifice.
Hey, Bill, repeat that one more time. I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that part.
Yeah, we all recognize that freedom of religion does the freedom to participate in human sacrifice. Religion requires their followers to sacrifice other humans. Lots of the pagan religions of the past, and there are even some today, one particular many people would be familiar with is the practice of sati over in India before the British outlawed that particular practice, where when the husband died, the wife was sacrificed on the funeral pyre with her husband's body, even though she was not dead. And that practice was outlawed by the British government when they took over India. That practice would not be allowed in America, even though we have freedom of religion. And we understand that sort of intuitively, but that type of thing has actually been argued in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has said, yes, the freedom of religion does have certain limits. One particular case that stands out where they did an excellent job of that was Davis versus Beeson in 1890, and it determined that the practice of polygamy was not protected by the First Amendment. Even though polygamy is a requirement in some Mormonism, by the First Amendment, according to the Supreme Court, there's a general rule of thumb in this area which apply equally in both the religious sphere and the secular sphere are not a violation of the free exercise clause. So for example, a law against murder is not a violation of the free exercise clause just because some religion out there may require you to murder someone. The reason it's not a violation of that clause is because it applies equally to those following a religion that demands human sacrifice and to those who do not. In a particular law is a violation of the free exercise clause, you have to show that it treats the followers of a particular religion differently from everyone else. So, a good example of that would be that case in Mississippi with the law saying that it could not have drive-in church services. And that's what the judge determined when he said that those laws were invalid. He said that you're creating churches specifically rather than a general rule that you're applying to anyone. That's why they were ruled to be an unconstitutional law. So things like fire codes, building codes, and health ordinances, they're not a violation of the free exercise clause, even though sometimes they may have the effect of prohibiting members of the church from meeting in a building, as you know, say a building that's been condemned. That's not them violating the free exercise clause just because they condemn a church building because it didn't pass fire codes or health codes. It's just them applying laws equally to everyone, including the church and the Christians. So most of the health orders that have been given out, the orders and stuff like that, have fallen into the same category as the fire codes and health ordinances, and they haven't violated First Amendment rights. And so now I've probably gotten a large portion of the audience upset because of saying that they don't violate the Constitution. But let me shift in addition to the First Amendment, there's also the Fifth Amendment. And there's a clause in the Fifth Amendment that is very, very, very important in application to these homeowners. It's the last clause of the Fifth Amendment. It's known in legal circles as the Takings Clause. And it simply says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And this is one of those clauses that has been litigated in the Supreme Court to no end, and almost universally they have agreed with the position I'm about to say. So multiple Supreme Court cases backing up this position. One of those was United States versus General Motors Corp. Court determined that the right to occupy a building for a day, a month, a year, or a series of years itself without reference to actual use needs collateral arrangements of the occupier. So the right to business that has a particular value. And if that just compensation has to be paid to the person that would normally occupy that building, so business that's renting the building or that owns the building, something like that, if they're told that's going to occupy that building. And so the government has to pay rent any time that they're going to occupy a building.
Hey, Bill, let me stop you really quickly. I'm having a little difficulty hearing you, so I want to take a really quick break and work out some technical difficulties I think we're having. But we're going to take a really quick break to our listeners out there. I want to make sure that you get the information that Bill is telling us. So we're going to take a really quick break, hopefully take care of any technical difficulties that we're having here. You can weigh in, of course, by calling in at 646-668-8485 and then press that 1. We'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
How do fantasy and sci-fi help make us into better people? And how can Christians best glorify our Lord Jesus Christ as we enjoy these stories? Also, where can you find the best fantastical Christian novels? Yes, they do exist, and we know exactly where to find them.
From the creators of Lorehaven magazine and from biblical Christian storytellers around the world comes a new podcast for readers of amazing stories. We call it Fantastical Truth.
I'm E. Stephen Burnett.
And I'm Zachary Russell. Our mission is to find biblical truth in fantastic stories. We apply the wonders of these imaginary worlds to the real world our Creator has called us to serve.
Toward that chief end, we will find the best novels by Christian authors, fantasy, science fiction, and beyond. Together, we will explore these stories in light of the gospel, and we'll join these authors and other creative friends on this joyful journey to find the happiness and holiness of Jesus by exploring His gift of truthful imagination.
Please subscribe at lorehaven.com or on podcast players everywhere.
Join us in this eternal quest to seek and find fantastical truth.
If you are an author looking to gain visibility for your books, then authorshout.com is the place to go. We have a wide variety of affordable products and services to include a member zone that will help you get the word out about your books. Our team here at authorshout.com specializes in creating stunning digital products to include book banners, teaser videos, book trailers, book covers, and a whole lot more. So what are you waiting for? Stop by authorshout.com today and let our team connect you with a world of new readers.
Are you an indie author looking to create audiobooks listeners will love? At The Audio Flow, we handle the entire process, from casting the perfect voice to distribution. Contact us today at 317-927-8770. The Audio Flow, a new way to do audio.
As an author, you understand the devastation of someone plagiarizing your work, but what if someone stole your identity? Protect yourself and your family with identity theft protection. Services include credit monitoring, credit reports and scores from all three credit bureaus, Social Security number, emails, credit cards, bank account monitoring, and social media monitoring from Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. For more information, call 248-525-7680.
Hi, and welcome back to the show. You're listening to the Parker J. Cole Show on WPJC 104.5, having a fantastic discussion with my guest co-host and contributor today, Bill Fortenberry. He is an author, researcher, and theologian. What we're discussing is, does God approve of the quarantine? We gave you some backdrop, letting you know there's a lot of conflict going on about the quarantine. Some people are completely against it. Others are saying you have to obey the law of the land. And for myself, one of the reasons why I asked Bill to come onto the show was because I wanted a balanced view, if a balanced view existed. So what Bill has done for us, he's given us four categories to consider when evaluating this particular subject. First, we have to look at biblical guidance. What does the Bible say about handling infectious diseases? Are there examples that we can use within the Word of God that will help us? Secondly, we have to look at our Constitution. What does the Constitution say about restricting people from assembling? Then we have to go to local and state authority, and then we have to look at our own selves and individual responsibility. Before the break, Bill had really did an exhortation, I want to say, of the what the Bible says about dealing with infectious diseases and what the guidelines were. And then he was going into the Constitution requirement. He started to get a little where he couldn't quite understand him, so I wanted to take a quick break to have him come back in. I think we got our problems set right now, so I'm going to have you, Bill, go back to your point, the point you were making about the government and General Motors and what had happened during that particular situation as we talk about the Constitution and how this affects the quarantine.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I think that was mostly on my end, but hopefully we got that fixed and taken care of now. All right. But,
you sounding good
but yeah,
now.
Like I was saying, all right. In the Supreme Court case, United States versus General Motors, back in the 1940s, this is after World War II, and the government had seized several buildings in Detroit in order to manufacture firearms and tanks and planes and things like that for the war effort during World War II. And they chose not to pay rent for some of those. And so the companies all sued. And many of those went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, in every case, ruled in favor of the company that was suing. And so in this particular case, they said that the government is required, whenever they occupy a building temporarily, they're required to pay, quote, the market rental value of such a building on a lease by the long-term tenant to the government. And so that's what they ruled, is that the government, when they occupy a building, and the ruling was very broad. It said even if the government doesn't do anything in that building, if they just take possession of it and kick the owner or the business that was in there, if they kick them out and they take possession, then they have to pay fair market value in rent any time they take temporary possession of a piece of property. And so applying that to the stay-at-home orders, there's another case that took that and broadened it even further. The Supreme Court case was Lucas versus South Carolina Coastal Council. So nice long case name there. And in that case, the court was trying to determine what is and what is not considered a taking in the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment. And they looked at this particular situation, and they said when the owner of real property has been called upon to sacrifice all economically beneficial uses in the name of the common good, that is, to leave his property economically idle, he has suffered a taking. And so this has direct application to all the orders that have been used to force non-essential businesses to close their doors. These orders are calling on business owners to leave their business property economically idle. So they're not allowed to go in and perform work and make a profit. So it's economically idle, and that's at the government's order. And according to the Supreme Court, the governments which have issued those orders are required by the Fifth Amendment to pay those businesses a just compensation for their losses. And so I think that every business that has been forced to close should obey the order, because it's a lawful order that the government has given them. and then they should sue the state or local government which issued that order and force the government to pay for that closure just like the Fifth Amendment requires. And this will do two things. It'll get the businesses the compensation that they need in order to survive this closure. And it will also make the government think twice about ever doing this again. Because if every single business does that, we're talking massive lawsuits against the government and massive payouts that they're going to have to make because of these orders that they've given. And they'll definitely think twice before ever doing this at any time in the future. So that's fascinating, I think, the Constitution requires of us. It requires of us to obey the order because they're not non-constitutional in most cases. But then afterwards, we have a responsibility to ensure that the Fifth Amendment is followed properly and that the government reimburses the businesses for that loss.
It's fascinating. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Please continue. Well, real quickly, I was going
to
say it's fascinating. Oh, good. It's fascinating to me because, you know, the Bible says my people perish for the lack of knowledge. And I know that's within a particular context, but you can also extrapolate from that. And I bet hopefully our listeners are listening and are going, okay, you know, because you have to remember our government is supposed to be a system of checks and balances. And we have to remember that people who owe the government, well, you do know we elect our government officials. You know, we do that. You know, we have the power. It's like when you talked last time on the show about sovereignty, about government, about democracy, and how the Israel, when they were talking with God, you know, through his leaders, they're talking through God, you know, it was a vote. You know what I mean? There was a vote to do these kind of things. And so I am reminded of that as you mentioned this, because if we don't know, how can we implement changes so this doesn't happen again, you know? And I think this is vital information that our listeners can really attach themselves to. And so before I go on to the next category, Bill, I just want to read a comment that we received, and I think it's going to be a good segue into the next category here. It's from Sheila in Detroit, Michigan. Sheila says, although some states have set in place limited restrictions, there is still a great need for us to maintain social distance. I am in favor of quarantine to continue. We must not be overzealous about getting out of our house. We must take this serious. We can quote all the statistical information and facts, but we, the bottom line, need safety. And then she says, I think it's too soon. And let me say this. We can discuss political party, beliefs, the status of the virus, but the bottom line is death does not care about anything. Sheila, thank you so much for joining in the conversation. Now, Bill, I don't know if you want to respond to what Sheila said or if your thoughts about the next category about state and local authority is going to add more context to her comment. So however you want to handle it, I'm fine with it.
Well, let's go on. I think we'll come back to that under the individual responsibility.
Okay.
But in a nutshell, just in case she's listening and not able to stay on to listen to the end of it, in a nutshell, I agree with her that we should comply with the orders. I don't think there's too many governors out there and mayors that are thinking, haha, I can become a dictator right now. There may be some, but there aren't too many doing that. They're generally trying to do what they think is best for us, and I don't have a problem with them doing that. I think they've made the wrong decision in many cases, but I don't have a problem with complying with it. I haven't worked in several weeks because I've been told not to work and to stay home. So I would agree with her in complying with that, primarily because they have the authority to do that, and we have a responsibility to obey them unless they violate some higher law.
Okay.
But let's go on down to state and local authority, and then I'll get back to that with individual responsibility after this one. So with state and local authority, one of the things we need to keep in mind is that all these stay-at-home orders that have been issued, they've all been issued by state and local governments. The federal government has not issued any type of stay-at-home order. They've given guidance and advice, but they haven't issued orders for the stay-at-home things. That's all come from state and local governments. Some of these orders have been violations of the law, and we mentioned the one in Mississippi, and there's been some others, and I'm okay with resisting the ones that are clearly violations of the law, but the majority are not violations of the law. There's clauses in most state laws that the citizens aren't really aware of. Last year, the CDC conducted a study, and I think it's kind of telling that they were conducting this study last year, and then we have this whole thing this year, but that's another topic. The CDC was conducting a study of the laws of all 50 states. They found that 42 out of the 50 states have laws which give the governor the authority to change the law at will during a declared state of emergency. So in other words, the laws of those states, and that's almost all of them, there's only eight that don't have this, the laws of those states basically say that the governor can do whatever he wants to do during a state of emergency. The governors of these states can issue whatever orders they want, and as long as they don't violate any federal laws, those orders are completely legal, and we're obligated to obey them. That's what the laws state in 42 out of the 50 states of the union. So most of the orders that have been given have been completely legal. They're not violating any of the state or local laws. A couple of them have violated the federal laws, and those have usually been dealt with and had positive resolutions. But for the most part, there's no law that these orders are violating. However, even though these orders are legal, the states which have implemented them are still required by the Fifth Amendment to provide that financial compensation for the loss of business that these orders have created. And in fact, some of the states actually have incorporated the Fifth Amendment requirement into their emergency laws. In my state, in Alabama, for example, the Emergency Management Act actually says, quote, in case property is taken for temporary use, the governor, within 30 days of the taking, shall fix the amount of compensation to be paid, and end quote there. So that's right there in the Emergency Management Act that gives the governor the authority to basically do whatever he or she wants. It still says that the governor has to pay for all these orders and has to, you know, cause the state to pay for the interruption of business. So this provision was included to remind the governor of his, or in this case, I have a female governor, so it would be her responsibility under the Fifth Amendment to pay for the economic damage that is caused by any of her emergency orders. Now, unfortunately, the governors seem to have forgotten about this requirement. If they remembered this requirement, they would not have issued the orders that they have issued. Or maybe they know about it and they're hoping the people have forgotten about it. But I can guarantee you that if we start suing for compensation that they're required to pay, so it's not asking for anything beyond what they are required by the Constitution to pay, and if we start suing for that, it'll be a very long time before the emergency powers are used this broadly again. So those powers are important for different things. So they were implemented, to give you an example, the most of these emergency powers and the laws for those were implemented during the Cold War, when we were very much afraid of a nuclear holocaust and, you know, the dangers of Russia nuking Washington, D.C., and now the states are on their own. What do they do? And, you know, so that's the type of situation that these laws were designed for. And they've been abused many times since they were put into effect. This is the most extensive abuse of those laws that we've ever seen. And so the check against that abuse is the requirement in the Fifth Amendment that the governments pay for the loss of business that those orders cause. And so if we don't implement that check, then the abuse is just going to get worse and worse in the future. Until we end up having no Fifth Amendment guarantee or protection. So that's what I look at on a state and local level. Now, of course, every state's going to have slightly different laws, and so you would have to look at the orders in your state to see if they are legal. For example, in my case, some of the orders that have been given on the city level have been illegal according to state law. They're not violations of federal law, but they have been violations of state law. And so I point that out, tell people that are in a position to do something about it, or people that are affected by it. None of them have affected me, but let people know they're affected by it, that, hey, this particular order is a violation of this state law, and here's how you can get that rectified. And that just has to be done on a case-by-case basis. But in general, the main thing we need to keep in mind is that Fifth Amendment requirement that the government pay for any type of loss that they cause a business to suffer during this time. So that brings us to the question of individual responsibility, which is what your commenter was talking about. And mm-hmm. So from what I can see, we have three responsibilities as individuals during this particular crisis. First of all, we should resist any order that directly violates a law, higher law, such as the law of God or our federal or state constitution. And we have, when we do that, we have to be willing to suffer the consequences of that resistance. When Peter and John told the Sanhedrin that they were going to preach what Jesus told them to preach regardless, mm-hmm. they got thrown in prison and they were beaten and beaten with whips and all that, and they rejoiced that they were in prison. They didn't go around saying, this is unfair that you're throwing me in prison. They rejoiced that they were thrown in prison for doing what was right, and that they just kept doing what was right in spite of being thrown in prison. And so we have to have that same attitude as Christians. If we stand up against something that is a violation of the law of God, we have to recognize we're probably going to be, ticketed and fined and things like that. But we don't get depressed. We recognize we're doing what God has told us to do, and we trust Him to take care of the consequences. And we just continue doing what is right. So that's the first thing. We resist any order that directly violates a higher law. Second thing, we need to submit to all orders that do not violate a higher law, even if we think those orders are pointless, stupid, or even harmful. And I would say that all three of those apply to many of the orders that I have seen that have come out. I've seen some pretty pointless and stupid orders come from these governors. I've seen some that I would even say are causing more harm than good. But if they don't violate a higher law, we're still obligated to submit to those orders. There's no higher law that says, for example, that we should not wear masks when we go out in public. I don't think it's going to help anything, but if the government orders that everyone in Alabama wear a mask in public for the next 2 months, I'm going to submit to that, and I'm going to wear a mask in public for the next 2 months, even though I think it's not right, I think it's pointless. I'm still going to do it because it's not a violation of a higher law, so I'm supposed to submit to that. And then thirdly, and I think most importantly, we have a duty to compel the governors to comply with the Fifth Amendment requirement that they pay for each and every business that was ordered to close their doors. This is not just a duty that we owe to our neighbors and ourselves. It's a duty that we owe to future generations of Americans. No government will ever take the initiative and limit its own powers. That's just not how government works. That's not how human nature works. Once they get power, they run with it as far as they can. So the only way for us to protect future generations from losing their Fifth Amendment rights is for us to force the government to submit to the requirements of that amendment now. And, even if you think the government is doing everything exactly right and doing everything right and ordering these stay-at-home orders and the quarantines and all that, they still have a responsibility to pay for it. They're the ones giving the order. They're the ones responsible for paying for it. And people don't often realize this, but we have not had a single day since about mid-2017, all the way up till now in 2020. We have not had a single day in that time in which our nation has not been in a declared state of national emergency. And there's a list of all the national emergencies. You can get it on a government website, a list of all the national emergency declarations, and you can look at them, and you can see it's continuous. From about mid-2017 till now, it's been completely continuous where we've been under a declared national emergency of some type or other that entire time. And our governors have finally figured out that the national emergencies give them a lot of power. And if we don't take steps to curtail the use of that power now, we can only expect to see it abused more and more in the future. And so that's what I think is our responsibility. We should resist any orders that violate a higher law, submit to the orders that do not violate a higher law, but we also have a duty to make sure that the governors comply with the Fifth Amendment and pay for those orders that they have given.
You know, Bill, I think you did a fantastic job really breaking down this topic. And the other questions I sent to you, you actually answered just in some of the other things you said earlier in our interview here. I did want to read just parts of one of our listeners, one of her comments. I can't read the whole thing just because of the we're running out of time here. But Carol from New York says, God knows when to go out of harm's way. He sent Jesus, Mary, and Joseph away into Egypt when Herod was after them. Why didn't he just miraculously hide Jesus? When Satan sprung Psalms 91 onto Jesus, Jesus told Satan another verse, a verse against presumption. Faith alone is not the way we get healed or protected. One can have great faith, but so many of us have sins and vices that affect us. The virus affects those who have pre-existing conditions very badly. If we have disobeyed God with gluttony, et cetera, should we expect God to protect us from our self-caused issue? And she goes on to say more, but I just don't have time to read the entire thing. But Carol, thank you so much for joining in the conversation. And Bill, I want people to get to see where you are online as we get ready to close our interview today. So tell us what your social media outlets are.
Okay, well, first of all, I have a blog. It's increasinglearning.com, and it comes from Proverbs 1:5, a wise man will hear and will increase learning. So increasinglearning.com. And then my personal Facebook account is facebook.com/Proverbs1.5. So it's that reference about a wise man will hear and will increase learning. And so either of those places, they can find me, get a hold of me, and contact me if they have questions. Let me quickly mention at the close here that I have that new book that should be coming out sometime this year. I finished the manuscript and cover design, and right now I'm sending out query letters to a couple of agents and seeking some endorsements from other historians. The book is entitled The Birthright, A History of Citizenship in America, and it traces the history of birthright citizenship all the way back to George Washington's administration, so all the way back to, and this, the oldest document I have is 1796. It's an eye-opening look at a question that's become one of the hallmarks of the Trump administration, which is, did our founding fathers intend for us to give citizenship to the children of illegal immigrants? And I depart from most conservatives, and I answer that question in the affirmative, and this new book explains why. So that's something to be looking for in the future, and I'm sure I'll come on and do a show about it once it's been released.
Looking forward to that. You know, we always like, you know, particularly for me, I like to entertain a lot of POVs for the most part because I don't believe in censorship. I think if you have a thought, you should be able to say it. It may be a stupid thought. I do think sometimes you can act silly things, but I do think you have the right to go ahead and say certain things, you know, and I love talking about it. So when that gets taken care of, Bill, just connect with me offline and we'll get you on the show, of course. And I want you to give us your final thoughts. Like I said, we are getting, we've actually are over time, but I wanted to really go into this topic, and I knew you would do a superlative job in breaking this down, and that's what I needed. I actually feel as if you've given me something to go, okay, I don't have to panic. I don't have to worry. There are recourses that people can take, and you really list that. Hopefully, if you haven't, Bill, you'll do a blog post that kind of substantiates what you talked about today. And if you do that, then I'll share it on my feed here with my listeners so they can just get like the Reader's Digest version of what you said here. But what are your final thoughts, Bill, as we get ready to close? What are your final thoughts?
Well, I'm not very good at final thoughts. the main thing, one of the reasons that I think for all the panic is that people are, they have an inherent need to sacrifice. It's something that God designed us for. He made us with a need to sacrifice ourselves for the greater good. And, you know, America is so wealthy that most people don't have that experience of sacrificing themselves for the greater good. And so when something like this comes along and, oh, now I can sacrifice, I can stay home, I can endure this hardship, and it really makes people feel good about themselves because that need is built into us. And You know, I think it's kind of sad that it takes something like this for us to feel satisfied when there are so many other ways that we can be sacrificing ourselves for better causes, for example, the pro-life cause, or for taking the gospel to places that have never heard. I mean, there's just so many things that we can do to sacrifice ourselves and our own comforts in the work of the Lord, but we just don't do it. And so my main final thought here is after this is over, you know, you're feeling like you really want to get back to that good feeling of sacrificing yourself, find a good cause and actually sacrifice to support that cause. There's lots of them out there. All you got to do is look for them.
You know, Bill, I think that's very insightful of you. I honestly didn't think that would be something you'd end the show on, but it does make me think, because people tend to think sacrifice should be a material thing. And like you said, particularly for us here in America, we're used to certain things and we're used to a certain style of living. And then when that is threatened, we're like, okay, I'm sacrificing, like you just said. And I remember I got a lot of flack actually when I shared a video in some country where the guy was out. Obviously he wasn't supposed to be out. You can only infer from the video because I didn't understand the language, but you can infer he wasn't supposed to be out, and the police were out running around beating him. They beat him with these metal poles, and they didn't beat him down. They beat him in warning, I should say. And I know that doesn't sound any better, but I was just like, you know, and I just said, stay home. But I said, we don't have that here, you know. And matter of fact, if that actually did happen, there would be so many people jumping through roofs to make sure that that never happens here. So there are certain things we are used to that certain parts of the world would never quite understand. Or they look at us like, wow. Even my missionary couple, he said, wow, these countries are so rich that they can give money to their citizens, and we're doing very, very bad here, you know. And I said, it's not quite what you think. But then I think about it from his point of view. He's like, wow, the government is giving you money. Now, whether I agree with that or not is another subject for another time. But at the same time, just on the outside looking in, you're like, wow, look at that country, you know. And so like you said, you know, when this is over, and it will be over because nothing lasts forever, it will be over, mm-hmm. We can still sacrifice in other ways, and we can still use that sincere desire to show sacrificial love in so many ways, particularly, like I said, the pro-life movement, because that was a service that's considered essential. Abortion was considered essential, right? And
right.
I remember that post you put out there. You said 20 people died today. No one said a word, you know. And
yep.
It was just very disheartening. You know, and yeah, I totally understood you. So I'm glad you said that. I'm glad we had you on the show today. Thank you so much. For those of you listening, you want to get to know more about Bill, go to increasinglearning.com. Again, increasinglearning.com. And thank you so much for joining me on this edition of the show. You have a wonderful, absolutely glorious, blessed day, and God bless.